The town of Kishinev is the capital of the Soviet state of Moldavia, which runs along the Russian border with Romania. Kishinev has a Jewish population today of some 60,000 people. And they suffer all of the opportunities and all of the oppression that's typical of Jewish life in the Soviet Union today. In 1961, the Jewish community was forbidden anymore to bar mitzvah any of its sons. In 1964, all of the synagogues in Kishinev, except one, was closed. In 1965, half of the Jewish cemetery of the community was torn up to make room for an urban renewal project, and no provision was made for the reinterment of the bodies which had been raised. In 1967, the majority of the Jewish students at the local university were expelled, dismissed from class, because they refused to sign a petition condemning Israel for its warlike Hitlerian actions in the Middle East. In Tsarist days, the town of Kishinev was the capital of the province of Bessarabia. Jews had lived in Kishinev from early in the 18th century. The town had grown insofar as the Jewish population was concerned throughout the 19th century. The Jews were crowded into the Pale of Settlement and forced from the villages and the farms into the city as a proletarian slave labor population for the emerging factories. Very few Jews in Kishinev were well-to-do, and owned factories where flour was milled, where tobacco was cured, where suits were made. Most of the Jews were poor, laborers who worked 6 days a week, 14, 16 hours a day, enslaved to try and bring home sufficient for their families. A notoriety, fame, came to Kishinev and came to its Jewish community of about 50,000 souls on Easter Sunday of 1903. Preceding that Easter, the government, through the newspapers, had unleashed a torrent of anti-Semitic vitriol. The protocols of the elders of Zion was being serialized week after week after week in Bessarabia, the local paper. The police chief was the most violent of those who repeated all the libels of the Middle Ages. On Good Friday, and again on Easter Sunday, the priests of the town got up in their synagogue, in their churches, and damned the Jews for having brought all kinds of evil, alien ideas, seditious ideas to Mother Russia. After all, what could one expect from the deicides, from the Christ killers, from those who had murdered the Lord? And on that Easter Sunday, the mob took to the streets. And for 6 days, there was a pogrom. So over 50 Jews were killed, 500 were seriously injured, 2,500 Jewish homes were torched, destroyed, 600 businesses stores were ruined. And during all of this, the police of Kishinev stood back. Reports had that many of the police were seen at the forefront of the mob. The government had a regiment, 5,000 troops in barracks just outside the town, and they were kept in the barracks. No attempt was made to protect the Jewish community. The 20th century had dawned. Russia had made very clear that it was part of her official policy though she still expressed it unofficially, to try and to force the Jewish community to disappear, to move out, destroy it, to blot it off the face of the earth. A century of genocide had begun. These were still years when nations reacted to violence and inhumanity in other nations. President Theodore Roosevelt wrote a very strong letter to the Tsar, which the Tsar's minister refused to receive. And Kishinev became in the Western world and among Jews the symbol town of the pogrom, of centralized, planned national anti-Semitism. It has remained a symbol of anti-Semitism in the 20th century to our day. Now, after the events of Kishinev of April of 1903, a young 28-year-old Russian Jewish poet, one of the first men to use Hebrew in our century as a vehicle for the expression of ideas and of beauty, Chaim Nachman Bialik, wrote an elegy, a lament to the martyrs, wrote an angry poem about the violence, the murderous attack in Kishinev, which he called Ir Haharega, the city of slaughter. Arise and go now to the city of slaughter. Into its courtyard wind your way. There with your own hand touch and with the eyes of your head behold on tree, on stone, on fence, on mural clay, the spattered blood and dried brains of the dead. And to the attic mount. Upon your feet and hands behold the shadow of death, among the shadows stand. There in the dismal corner, there in the shadowy nook, multitudinous eyes will look upon you from their somber silence. The spirit of the martyrs are these souls, gathered together at long last, beneath these rafters and in these ignoble holes. The hatchet found them here, and here do they come to seal with a last look, as with their final breath, the agony of their lives, the terror of their death. Tumbling and stumbling race, they come and cower there, their silence whimpers, in their eyes which cry, wherefore, O Lord, why? It is a silence only God can bear. Lift then your eyes to the roof. There's nothing there save silences that hang from rafters and brood upon the air. Question the spider in his lair. His eyes beheld these things, and with his web he can a tale unfold, horrific to the ear of man. A tale of cloven belly, feather-filled, of nostrils nailed, of skull-bones bashed and spilled, of murdered men who from the beams were hung, of a babe beside its mother flung, its mother speared, the poor chick finding rest upon its mother's cold and milkless breast, of how a dagger halved an infant's words, its ma was heard, its mama never heard. Oh, even now its eyes from me demand accounting, for these the tales the spider is recounting. Tales that do puncture the brain, such tales that sever your body, your spirit, your soul from life forever. Then will you behold your spirit. Hold, enough. Stifle that wrath that mounts within your throat. Bury these things accursed within the depth of your heart, before your heart will burst. There was the lament, the sorrow, and the pity, the anger at another evidence of man's cruelty to man, to the Jew. But there was more here. For Bialik was angry not only at the Tsar and at his minions, not only at the peasant who vented his hate, his brute, dumb hate, but he was angry at his own people. His people who had sat hidden quietly in terror, fearful to show themselves, who had made no attempt to fight back, to defend their own. Note also, do not fail to note in that dark corner and behind that cask, crouched husbands, bridegrooms, brothers, peering from the cracks, watching the sacred body struggling underneath the bestial breath, stifled in filth and swallowing their blood. Watching from the darkness and its mesh, the lecherous rabble portioning for beauty their kindred and their flesh. Crushed in their shame, they saw it all. They did not stir nor move. They did not pluck their eyes out. They beat not out their brains against the wall. Perhaps each watcher had it in his heart to pray, "A miracle, O Lord, spare my skin this day." Those who survived this foulness, who from their blood awoke, beheld their life polluted, the light of their world gone out. How did their menfolk bear it? How did they witness this yoke? They crawled forth from their holes, they fled to the house of the Lord, they offered thanks to him, the sweet benedictory word. And the Kohanim sailed forth to the rabbi's house, they flitted. "Tell me, O rabbi, tell me, is my own wife permitted?" The matter ends, and nothing more. All is as it was before. Come now, and I will bring you to their lairs, the privies, jakes, and pig pens, where the heirs of Hasmoneans lay, with trembling knees, concealed, cowering, the son of the Maccabees. The seed of saints, the scions of the Lion of Judah, who crammed by scores in all the sanctuaries of their shame, so sanctified thy name. It was the flight of mice they fled. The scurrying of roaches was their flight. They died like dogs. They were dead. Coward, concealed and cowering, sons of the Maccabees. What bitter, caustic sarcasm, anger. Here are these lights, which have been lit for 2,100 years, lit in honor of Jewish courage, the willingness to brave the sword of another czar. His name was not Alexander, but Antiochus. His throne name was Epiphanes, the God manifest. His subjects called him Epimanes, mad god. For like the Tsar of Mother Russia, the Tsar of the Seleucids of Syria was determined to turn his empire into one grand, unified, Greek, Hellenistic nation. He saw no reason why Jerusalem should be governed by the Torah as a constitution, our peculiar law. He saw no reason why the temple should be reserved and sacred to the one invisible God. All Greek temples were open to all the gods. He saw no reason why the Jews should obey a peculiar God's law rather than his own. And he set about to enforce his will. This God manifest, this mad God, to enforce his will upon the people. And like the Tsar, he had an army. And as in Russian days, so those centuries before, there were many who looked askance at the unwillingness of the Jew to be ecumenical, agreeable, to go along, to accept the manners and the values of the larger society. And as I read to you from the Chronicle of the Maccabees this morning, they came to all the little kishnefs of ancient Judea in force, to enforce their will. And though here was the might of an empire and here an unarmed people, one of them, Mattathias, would not cower and would not hide himself. And he struck down the education and information officer who appeared to demand his act of obeisance. And he and his five sons took to the hills. and began what was probably, what must be called, the first war of liberation in the history of mankind. Now, rehearsing the history of the Maccabees and placing it against the history of Kishneff, Chaim Nachman Bialik was moved to compare the Jews of that day and of his. And out of that comparison came his great love of Zionism, because he said, only when we stand as a people free in our own land can the latent dignity of the Jew emerge. And it is not enough to take the Jew out of Russia, out of the diaspora. We must somehow take Russia, the diaspora, out of the Jew. We must find a way to create a new Jew who will not always be looking over his shoulder, be fearful, be coward, be broken in spirit. One who has the courage to stand up and defend the elemental and basic human rights, which are inalienably his own. I did not rehearse the history of Kishneff, nor read to you Bialik's Yir HaHariga, simply to speak to you of his conversion to Zionism. But I want to juxtapose this history to the mood of our own day. For we are the sons of a peace-urgent generation. The most ubiquitous of all symbols is the peace circle. Cars bear the sticker, another family for peace. Women wear jewelry which says, war is no good for children and other living things. There is a mood abroad in the land which looks on anyone who wears a uniform as a pig. Somehow the mood has developed that we must have nothing to do with war or any preparations for war or defense, call it what you will. That man can find his dignity and make a statement about the future, about his own self-worth, his own commitment, only if he withholds himself completely from all that smacks of defense, of war, of violence. We must meet violence with love, war with joyous commitment to our ideals. So runs a rather innocent and romantic tradition which grows out of the New Testament tradition. You know, if a man strikes you on one cheek, turn thou the other one also. A tradition which was encouraged by the success of Mahatma Gandhi in India, bringing about the independence of that subcontinent from Imperial Britain. I've tried to juxtapose in my own mind this history and this mood. They seem so very, very antithetical. And I wonder about our mood. I stand in a tradition. I preach a way of life which is peace intoxicated. David sang out in the Psalms, Bakesh Shalom V'Radfehu, seek ye peace, pursue it. The messianic dream is of a time when every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid, for they shall have beaten their swords into pruning hooks and their spears into the implements of farming. How beautiful upon the mountaintops is the bearer of the good tidings of peace. We greet each other with the word shalom, peace. Our tradition reveres peace. We are to be peacemakers. And yet at the same time, our history tells us that 1,000 years of turning the other cheek did not lessen the bloodlust or the anger, or reduce the level of violence of the malevolent, of the tyrannical, of those who hate it. Forget the judgments that Bialik made on those who hid themselves at Kishinev. The point is, they did not fight back. Now, would we not believe that not having fought back, they would have shamed the violent? 2 years later, in 1905, there was another terrible pogrom in Kishinev. And what of the daily legion of Jewish men, women, and children from all the towns and hamlets and cities of Europe, who in the late 30s and early 40s marched silently, unaggressively to the station and into the cattle cars, and from the cattle cars to the camps, and from the camp barracks to the ovens? Did their quiet nobility shame in Eichmann? Was a single Jew saved by their willingness to accept the intolerable? An historian some 30 years ago wrote a history of the Jews which he called Sufferance is the Badge. Well, we suffered the intolerable for 1,000 years. From the time of the Crusades, when the Jews went into the small synagogues of Worms and Cologne and of Frankfurt and sat there at their prayers while the Crusader on his way to the Holy Land set fire to their synagogues and burnt them within. To Dachau and Auschwitz, sufferance was the badge. And did our pacifism, our unwillingness to strike back, stop the fist, stay the sword? Not at all. What of Gandhi? The great proof text in modern times that nonviolence, total, complete nonviolence is the way. Gandhi was a great man. And Gandhi did bring about, help achieve the independence of India. But in the equation of Gandhi's nonviolence, there is a hidden force. The force of a subcontinent of people, 500 million people, whom England could not force to work. Forced into the fields, force into the factories. There was always the implicit threat in Gandhi's nonviolence that if I am killed, 500 million people will simply refuse to cooperate, and you, little England, with a few tens of thousands of soldiers here in India, you cannot force us to do your will. But there have never been 500 million Jews. We've been a minority of a minority, and minorities cannot stay the anger of the imperial power, of the tyrant, simply by standing on their decency and on their dignity. And that's the simple truth of our history, like it or not. What's for it then? There's a great deal said these days about conscientious objection. I will not fight. Hell no, we won't go. And there are good reasons not to go to Vietnam. But the danger is to assume that Vietnam is the paradigm of all wars, of all stress situations in which man must make some judgment to fight or not to fight. No one wants to shed blood. No one wants to be trapped into the passion, the hate, the fear, the anguish which war involves. And yet, can we take what seems to be the principle, the noble, the romantic, the innocent position? Under no situations, under no conditions, at no time, where I allow myself to wear a uniform to be involved in war. Now, if our history has any meaning, the answer must be no. For the minorities of the world, the Jews, the Ebus, the Armenians, not to fight, if pressed into the corner, is to commit suicide. You will not find in our religious tradition any justification of conscientious objection as an absolute. In the Bible, we're told that the king has the right to levy, to mobilize troops, to draft. And whenever through the ages the rabbis were confronted with a religious question, must we agree to participate in the draft of our country? The answer was, yes, if the country is being attacked, the Jew must pay the price that all citizens must pay. But if you will not find in our tradition a defense of conscientious objection, you will find in our tradition a defense of what is called today selective conscientious objection. The need that to make a judgment about each individual case in which we are summoned to take up the sword or the gun. There is in the Bible the category of milchemet mitzvah, wars which are obligatory. There are two kinds. The first war of conquest. Under God's will, the Jews occupied the Holy Land. And beyond that, only this. Any time when the Jews in Israel, their cities, their homes, their farms were attacked, the Jew was to respond, was to defend himself. That was a milchemet mitzvah, an obligatory defense. Self-defense is obligatory in our tradition. And obviously what I'm trying to do this morning is to suggest to you that there is a difference between Vietnam, between Israel, between war and war. It's too pure, and too innocent, and false to history to say, at no time, under no conditions, in no way will I entangle myself in human violence. You're entangled in life. You can't escape human violence. It's one thing to say, I will not involve myself in a war 5,000 miles from home, which involves obviously economic imperialism and almost nothing else. But it's quite another thing to say, my city, my family, those I know, love, my neighbors, are threatened by the anger and the racial hate of neighbors about us, and they will not sit down with us and negotiate a settlement, and I must take up a gun, arms, in order to defend my right to breathe, my family's right to live, to enjoy and survive in those cities, in those places which we have built. There's a hidden history in the story of Hanukkah. The first part of the story you know well. There was this attack upon the rights of the Jews to the freedom of their temple and their religious expression. And there was a guerrilla war led by Mattathias and Judah the Maccabee. And the war, because of a strange concatenation of events, which was explained in those days as a miracle of God's power, the war was successful. And 3 years after, they took to the hills Judah and his band entered Jerusalem and purified the temple and celebrated the first Hanukkah. That's the story we all know. The sequel to the story is this. Once the temple had been purified, Judah summoned together his soldiers and said, now is the time for us to establish a great Jewish nation. I'll lead you from victory to victory. I want to establish my family as a dynasty, and we'll go out and we're going to attack the Idumeans, and we're going to attack the Moabites, and we're going to attack the Nabateans, and we're going to take some of the cities which they are rich cities, and some of the land which is fertile land, and we're going to build up a great kingdom, very much like the kingdom of David and Solomon. Come and follow me. Drunk with victory, one would have expected the Jewish nation to go from attack to attack. And some who were more aggressive and who were among the more belligerent went with Judah. But the Hasidim, the Hasidians as they're called, the religious, the great body of the people refused to go along. They deserted the banner of Judah at that very moment of victory. And they went back to Modi'in, and they went back to Jerusalem and to all of their cities because they said, we fought the battle of the Lord when we had to fight it. We're not going to fight a dynastic battle for you. We're not going to fight a battle of conquest. That's warmongering. That's belligerency. They took the road of selective, conscientious objection. We will fight when forced. We will not fight as most men fight, so that one dynasty can oust another, so that one ruler can oust another, so that one rich man can become richer from the taxes of a city that is conquered for him. And that's the Jewish way. To take up arms when one needs to, and only when one needs to. But not to be afraid of taking up arms and doing what has to be done if one's back is to the wall, and if the enemy presses home and will not give us the room, the opportunity to breathe, to live, to survive. Life requires, above all else, judgment. There are no simplicities. Peace is a great word. The symbol is a beautiful symbol, a circle. But it's too neat. Life doesn't permit us this kind of neatness. Most wars in history should never have been fought. There are wars of greed, wars of bloodlust. But that doesn't mean that at times we don't have to be Maccabees and fight for decency, for basic inalienable rights, for the simple right to live. Seek peace and pursue it, peacefully if possible. But don't be afraid of taking the sword in the hand, if and when you have to. Amen.